Namaste, everyone, and welcome to Dharma Talk. I'm your host, Baba Shivaram Sarasvati. So today we're going to talk about one of the interesting ways that Sanatana Dharma has come into the West, a rather interesting popular culture conduit that the Dharma has used to finger into the Western culture. So today, the title of today's show is Hippies and Hindus, the Spiritual Roots of the 1960s Counterculture. Tobias Churton wrote a wonderful book called The Spiritual Meaning of the 60s. And in the book, he presents the hypothesis, this 1960s counterculture was a collective incarnation of Shiva in this world. The 1960s counterculture was a collective incarnation of Shiva in this world. So I would like to look at that hypothesis critically, not negatively, but critically, and see what kind of evidence we can find of that being the case. However, I'd like to suggest we modify the hypothesis before we go forward, and we say, rather than a collective incarnation of Shiva in the West, more of a revolution of consciousness, a mass instantiation of Shiva and Krishna and Kali consciousness in the West. So if you think about 1950s America, Dr. Cornel West wasn't referring specifically to the 50s, but he offered four characteristics of the neo-Victorian dominant culture: dogmatism, orthodoxy, rigidity, and self-righteousness. And in that setting, rather spontaneously, a revolution of consciousness came about. And I've studied a lot of this in undergraduate studies. I was a history minor, and this was a particular area of interest for me. But in the last decade or so, In quiet moments of reflection, it has occurred to me that there are some very interesting parallels between Shiva consciousness, Kali consciousness, Krishna consciousness, collectively and separately, parallels between that consciousness and the consciousness that seemed to grow out of the 1960s countercultures, because there wasn't one coherent counterculture. There were many countercultures that aggregated on different levels. So let's look at some of those parallels. And remember, the context of this show right now, the focus of this year of shows, is how can we take the Sanatana Dharma and practice it in the West? What sort of modifications to Western culture are going to be required to accommodate that, right? So if you believe all beings are manifestations of divine consciousness, your attitude toward animal welfare is going to be different from someone who does not. But we don't have to necessarily assume Indian-style cultures to practice the Sanatana Dharma, and here's why. Many traditions assert that originally, in the first age of humankind, all of humanity had access to the exact same spiritual tools. And then over time, as the ages progressed, some cultures became more alienated to their true nature than others. for different reasons, some cultures preserve the ancient Dharma much better than others. So right now, our big source of this ancient spirituality does go back to usually to India and also later to Tibet. That doesn't mean that we have to become Indians in order to practice this. And keep in mind, there are so many beautiful Indian cultures, and I love it. I love the clothing. I love the food. I love the smells. I love the colors. I love all of it. But I can honestly say that adopting a different culture isn't actually necessary. The basic tenets of Sanatana Dharma are incredibly portable. They can be implemented into any cultural setting, including the ones here in the West. So I don't think there was any kind of an organized conspiracy to make the average upper middle class young man look like a Hindu sadhu. But what if this kind of consciousness, for whatever reason, what if this consciousness went from India to Great Britain during the colonial era, aided by brilliant men such as the pseudonymous Sir Arthur Avalon, who translated some of the tantras and some of the important source works into English. What if that came from India via Britain, then to America, and got a foothold? What if that consciousness found a bunch of people that were dissatisfied in life and were questioning their dominant culture, and they wanted to find an alternative? Because I'm dissatisfied with Eisenhower's America, it doesn't really mean anything. You can't meaningfully turn away from something without turning toward something else. And if you do try to turn away to an undesignated something else you may not like where you set off to. So I think a lot of people looked for solutions to the dogmatism, orthodoxy, self-righteousness of the West. They looked to the East because they saw that as a source of spiritual freedom, a different sort of spirituality. So let's look at these emergent similarities. You can't talk about hippies without talking about long matted hair. And similarly, you can't talk about sadhus without talking about jatas, or what are known in America as dreadlocks. There's been so much written about the myth of the hippie and whatnot. So I'm borrowing a convenient term for dominant culture questioning long-haired bohemian youth of the 60s. When I use that term, that's what I'm specifically referring to. And see, you have these young men and women that look like sadhus. This is an amazing thing. And I don't think they were copying sadhus, because they probably weren't familiar with what a sadhu was. So is that an emergent Shiva consciousness? I think it might be. Also in the 60s, alternative subcultures, there was a huge emphasis on forest, nature, animals, spirituality of nature. From what I can tell, it was kind of a simplistic emotionally gratuitous kind of a spiritualization of nature, but they were headed in the right direction. And so I would say that is an emergence of Shiva consciousness in the West. There are some interesting, I guess, kind of symbolic links. Like, I remember as a teenager seeing the film of Jimi Hendrix burning, ritually burning his guitar at the Monterey Pop Festival. Now I look at that and I think, without any really specific intention on Hendrix's part, was that an emergence of a Shiva consciousness? Was that was Hendrix resonating at a Shaivite frequency, so to speak, and becoming the sadhu who's offering that which is most sacred to him to the supreme divinity, using the mouth of the fire god Agni, sacrificing his guitar? I have no idea if that's what was going in his mind. However, the image is an emergence of Shiva consciousness in the West. The sadhu wandering monk, right, with the loincloth and a pouch to carry the chillum, and a staff with a trident on it, a trishul on it, wandering from place to place. And then you have these deadheads. Is that an emergence of Shiva consciousness? Hordes of young people developing a sense of, well, it's not even a sense of community, a sense of union with each other, that moves from place to place. I would say that's a candidate for an emergence of Shiva consciousness in the West in the 60s. Cannabis was, Europe was familiar with cannabis for a long time, because of the connection of empire. Certainly the British were familiar with cannabis for a long time, but there's not much of a record that I can find of many people using it on any kind of significant level. And then all of a sudden, during this time of emergent Shiva consciousness, emergent Krishna consciousness, emergent Kali consciousness, all of a sudden, all of the young people are eschewing alcohol, which is forbidden by all of the Hindu deities, except for a very limited ritual context, in favor of ganja, which by all accounts, they would pass the joint around in a circle. A circle is a symbol of unity. It became a sacramental communion. And I know, obviously, there are plenty of people within and without India, worldwide, there are people who abuse the ganja, and they're not using it for a sense of union, and it's just an intoxicant. So I'm not referring to that at all. But for those who were serious spiritual seekers, a lot of them did, in the accounts that I've studied, they did view the smoking ritual as a source of a feeling of union, of one. And again, I think when you look at all of these other possible emergences of Shiva consciousness in the West, this fits in with the general picture, right? We're moving away from the individual kind of confused intoxication of alcohol toward the more socially mediated intoxication experience of ganja, which is what the sadhus use it for. Also, they pass the chillum around ritually, and it's kind of an act of communion and of ritual union. We are one. We are one with all. Let's see. So then. another interesting kind of an emergence of possibly emergence of Shiva consciousness in the West in the 60s. The hippie uniform, you know, the simple natural fabrics, the love beads, which I guess popular fashion grabbed the sadhu's mala around his neck and manifested it in a plastic form. But I think the love beads are symbolically kind of, I think they're malas. From the accounts of people at that time that I've studied, for some, it did have kind of a spiritual significance. So, and the interesting thing is, they didn't say, hey, we're going to pretend to wear malas. It just kind of emerged. It was an emergent consciousness. It wasn't something imposed from the outside by some kind of Hindu missionary or Buddhist missionary. It wasn't something being pushed by a government or an institution. All of these things just kind of emerged at the same time. Other symbolic links, the films of the young people bathing in the stock pond at Woodstock. You can't see that and not think, that looks like Sadhu's bathing in the Ganges. And the film about the bus trip that Ken Kesey took with his merry pranksters, there's a scene where they find some water in the desert and they're kind of ritually bathing, and a lot of, some paint gets involved and tie-dye gets involved. But it still, it kind of brings to mind ritual, spiritual, Shaivite bathing. I've jotted down some kind of just links. We don't have to prove this in academia or in a court of law. It's just some musings, just some things to think about. So the hum of the amps on the Woodstock album, because remember the recording technology wasn't especially great, and they were recording under very austere conditions out in the middle of nowhere. And so on the album you can hear, and it occurred to me a few times, that sounds kind of like some of the meditation instruments that we use in Tantra, which keep kind of that low, kind of a hum going during the meditation session. The Woodstock gathering itself, I wonder, is that an emergence of Shaivite consciousness in the West? Because when you look at a documentary, or if you're blessed enough to attend the Kumbh Mela, a gathering of sadhus that takes place on a 12-year cycle at different river sites, it's a coming together like that. And just like at Woodstock, there is mass feeding of these sadhus who, for most of the time, they live as wandering solitaries in the Himalayas or in the forest or in the plains. But every so often, at a time dictated by, you know, moon sign and astrological calendar, they all come together in unity. They meet together and compare experiences and worship their deities. And then when it's over, they all go their different ways. So that's kind of a spiritual Woodstock that's been happening in India for a very, very long time. Let's go back to this ganja thing, because in my interaction with young people on social media, they always nervously try to get around to the question of ganja. I would be remiss in doing a show on emergent Shiva consciousness in the West in the 60s, without going into a little bit of a discussion of ganja in a tantric, in a Shaivite context. To the sadhu, what's happening is the ganja, the sacred ganja burning in the bowl. The sadhu is exchanging his infatuation and intoxication with maya and illusion for the intoxication of the bliss of union with Shiva. And that's what it means to the sadhu. We're not talking about, you know, smoking a blunt on the way to the club and behaving in antisocial ways. This is quite a different sort of a use of the same plant. So that's the context in which the sadhu is using it. The children of the 60s that I've been fortunate enough to get to know refer to it as a special, as a, they kind of see it, I think, in their own way. They describe it in the way that a sadhu would describe it. So I do think that's an emergence. There are some interesting correlations between children of the 60s descriptions of their experiences and then conversations I've had with sadhus all over India about how that works there. So my statement on it is, talk to your guru about it if you want to explore the use of it in spiritual life. Don't haphazardly just go and grab a sacred sacrament and jump into it, because you may not have good results. This, how can I put it? If I were a Roman Catholic priest and I found out that people were taking consecrated communion wine and using it for recreational purposes, I would not encourage that, right? That's, if I found out people were using consecrated wine and then getting on the freeway, I would say, oh, well, that's terrible. And I'll say the same thing about ganja. So if it's legal where you live and your guru has given you instruction on how to do it correctly, and you're not in recovery from heroin addiction or something where, you know, it's going to cause a relapse, then it's something to talk about with your guru. But it is something that is part of a lot of these tantric traditions, and nobody ever wants to talk about it. So I'm talking about it. It's not something like, why should we pretend that the traditions don't have this feature? Let's talk about it openly. There's nothing evil or weird or terrible about it. And it is an opportunity to discuss maybe seeing cannabis as something other than a casual recreation project, that's used as an escape, and it can be used under a guru's guidance, maybe productively. So now that's been discussed. All right, heavy metal. So when you listen to the heavy metal of the late 60s, probably very few Westerners would say, oh, wow, that has the spiritual fingerprints of an ancient spiritual tradition all over it. But in fact, I think maybe it does. The Agore sadhus are mostly Shiva and Kali devotees. They dress in black. They hang out in cremation grounds. They smoke ganja. They have rituals that use human skulls. They're super duper scary to Western people. But they are in fact very devout monks. And Aghori means no fear. So what they're saying is, we're losing all of our attachments. And because we've lost all of our attachments, we've lost all of our fears. Heavy metal in general, the feel of it is like that. It's an abandonment of attachments. Now, I'm not going to vouch for every heavy metal lyric ever written, but in general, you see a heavy metal band of that age, and you kind of think about Shiva on riding at breakneck speed on Nandi, going down some road, followed by his band of unruly converted demons and goblins that have switched over to his side to become good guys. Shiva, the radical transformer, and in some of the more aggressive heavy metal, Bhairava, the fierce aspect of Shiva. In a sense, a lot of the what may be Iron Maiden makes me think of the Shaivite scripture of the destruction of Daksha's sacrifice, where I think we read it last week or the week before here on the show. Parvati's father, Shiva's father-in-law, throws a big feast and fire sacrifice, and he doesn't invite Shiva and Parvati. And so Parvati says, well, I'm Daksha's daughter, and if I want to go, I'm going to go. So she goes without an invitation, and Shiva ends up crashing the whole thing with this horde of goblins and demons that he's converted over to be good guys fighting on his side. And the whole festival is trashed, and it's just a big violent mess. So we went into the spiritual significance of that before, but the next time an old heavy metal song comes on, think about Shiva, because maybe there was kind of a Shaivite impulse there, an emergence of Shiva consciousness in the West, spontaneously. Yeah, I mean, think about it. Daksha, Shiva's father-in-law, is a symbol of orthodoxy, dogmatism, rigidity, and self-righteousness, right? Racism and prejudice and that's Daksha. That's Daksha. Those negative energies have always been, present in humankind. Daksha was orthodoxy, dogmatism, rigidity, and self-righteousness incarnate. And what happens? Shiva comes through and wrecks the whole festival of orthodoxy, dogmatism, rigidity, and self-righteousness. So what's Shiva really telling us with this story? He's saying, if we're willing to accept his reordering, his house cleaning of our consciousness, he'll accept anyone. Anyone can approach him. Daksha's sacrifice was about exclusivity. Shiva is about inclusivity. He's saying he's in radical opposition to anything where everybody is not invited in a spiritual sense. Exclusivist, us versus them kind of religion. Shiva, by nature, calls us to union, to unity with all beings and the supreme divinity. Let's see the puja now. I was thinking about the puja with in relation to these rock concerts that spontaneously arose in Western culture all of a sudden. So you do have you have chant, you have drum beat, you have an offering of bright lights and of sound. You have visualizations that the leader of the ceremony is leading you through. And I don't think they do this anymore, but at one point in history, there was a great cloud of some herbal incense that would rise up out of all of the rock concerts. I'm not sure if they know what it was, but there was clearly an offering of dhup or incense. And I think maybe sometimes the deities can be worshipped on an unconscious level, where your divine core knows what's going on, but you're not consciously aware that you're engaging in a worship experience. Some time ago, a young lady was telling me on social media, on my website, she wrote that she was seeking a spiritual experience. And I said, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. But, you know, there's a deity, whoever you are, however you are, there's a manifestation of divine consciousness that will reach out to meet you. And so she characterized herself as a follower of a certain rock band. She's traveled to different cities, a great devotee of the band. And then, oddly enough, there followed a discussion of she didn't understand why God would have a need to be worshipped. And I said, well, the same reason the people in the band that you enjoy so much need to be worshipped, and the same reason you feel the need to worship that band. And she said, well, that wasn't worship. And I said, well, of course it was, and there's nothing wrong with that. You were paying devotion to their creativity and musical talent and whatever subcultural institutions they stand for, and there's nothing wrong with that at all. But it is an act of devotion. It is an act of worship. And so all you have to do is to find a deity that's as interesting as your favorite performer or celebrity, and boom, you're a living saint. And I'm not exaggerating by much. The day you find your deity, the day you make the connection with your deity, sainthood is yours. From then on, it's a choice of what kind of a saint you want to be and how effective you want to be as a saint. I don't think that there are just a few that are called to a sacred life. All beings are on a journey to moksha. And in that context, we're all called to deep dedication to spiritual living, because that's the determinant of happiness. Now, let's see. We've covered rock and roll and drugs. Oh, drugs other than ganja, well, I don't want to discuss those. I think those may have been distortions and misunderstandings and mistakes. But we've covered sex we've covered rock and roll and drugs. So now we'll get to the sex part. I think there was an emergence of Shiva consciousness in that regard too. Now, in my lineage, I received the tradition that the universe is created by the union of consciousness and energy, of Shiva and Shakti, the lingam and the yoni uniting to create all that is. Energy dancing on the stage of consciousness. So on the microcosmic level, the male and the female are the two sex partners coming together. We don't have to specify genders, I don't suppose. When they come together, an energy is something is created as energy and consciousness meet. A synergistic reaction happens, and bliss results. I've spoken with yogis that say that the bliss of ganja and the bliss of sexual orgasm are the first taste. That's the first sample of bliss that the average being gets. It's a taste. It's something to whet the appetite for bliss. So it's good in that sense. However, if you stop there and you say, well, this is a source of bliss and this is a source of bliss, and you have the sex and you have the ganja, you're never going to get beyond. You're going to plateau at that level of bliss. It's a fine level of bliss with both of them. But it's limited, you know, and you can get desensitized to it. So those two, whenever you can hit bliss somewhere in the mundane world, the only reason you've experienced that is to make you think, hey, I really like bliss. I wonder if there's some way I can experience this on a deeper, fuller level, and do so on a regular basis. And so if you think of it in terms of chakras, that usually the kundalini is coiled like a serpent down at the muladhara chakra between the genital and the anus. And then the energy, the kundalini is stimulated, right? And it rises up to the next chakra, which is in the region of the bladder and the genitals. So that energy is stimulating. So you can spend that kundalini energy when it rises there on sexual bliss. And there's not a thing wrong with it. I'm not a Victorian. I'm not a Puritan. Sex isn't evil. Sex isn't weird. Sexual energy is like all other kinds of energy in the human body. It's just energy. It takes a sexual form when it's in that particular spot of the body. However, you can learn to meditate and kind of push that energy with your mind up a notch, and you can become like a fat monk who takes great pleasure in food, but he has no need for spending energy on sex anymore. And you can get your dopamine rushes from food. And there's nothing wrong with that if you're not eating yourself to death. Enjoying your food is a wonderful thing. Then you can push it up a little bit higher, and then higher. And as you go, you push the energy up through the chakras, all the way to the top. The energy of the goddess, the Kundalini energy, is moving up through that channel, eventually to the crown, to unite with Shiva. And then, and this really isn't that hard to learn. It doesn't take 16 years living in a cave in Tibet. It's not a hard thing. I was taught specific techniques that involved using body muscles to push the Kundalini up through, up all the way to the crown chakra. But I think you can will it. You can just focus on it, visualize it, find out where the energy is in your body. If you're trying to lose weight and you are craving a bunch of stuff that you're going to be unhappy that you ate, you just got some Kundalini. You got to bring that up. Bring it all the way on up. Bring it up into your chest and sing kirtan. Let it come out that way. Bring it up to the mouth and call someone and provide words of encouragement. Or sit in a quiet place. Bring it all the way on up to the top. Let Shiva and Shakti meet. Energy and consciousness meet. And bliss will result there. So, yep, it's true. The sexual bliss, the ganja bliss, it's a gimmick. They just want to, the universe wants you to get a taste of bliss and come to it looking for more. Well, fortunately, that doesn't cost anything, and it's not hard to do. Pursuing bliss involves finding which deity you can make a connection with, jumping into that relationship with both feet, and the deity will lead you to the bliss. So, free love versus Victorian Puritanism. Well, I guess thinking of the union of Shiva and Shakti as a casual recreation is probably not going to lead to, generally to positive things. On the other hand, the Victorian, Neo-Victorian Puritanism causes all sorts of mental illness and terrible things with people because you just can't tell a bunch of Westerners don't be sexual. In the East, there have always been tools for handling that where you say, you can spend energy on sex or you can spend it on something better. In the West, it's, hey, just don't do that. Don't think about it. Don't. No, 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 no. And psychologically, that it turns out is not especially good for people in general. So I say neither free love nor Victorian Puritanism, but rather Tantra. Some Indian peasants, when they saw the throngs of Western young people heading into regions like Goa in the late 60s, they thought these were, the young people were refugees from famine and drought. And they were spiritual refugees. They were fleeing the sterile rigidity and existential despair of the postmodern West. So I'd like to propose the hypothesis that the attractive element, the mass consciousness that invited Shiva consciousness, Krishna consciousness, Kali consciousness into the West, particularly among young people in the 60s, was a sense of existential despair a play, I think, or a novel where the last scene is, I believe it's two homeless alcoholics watching two rats fight over a crust of bread, and one of them asks, is that all there is? And the other replies, yes, I think that's all there is. So out of the despair of the West, the nuclear despair of the West, there was a yearning, a desire for a new consciousness. And I think that may have attracted Shiva to start answering prayers in the West. Elaine Danilou was, I mentioned him before on the show, an outstanding academic practitioner of Tantra. He was a great Shaivite scholar of the 20th century. And he wrote a book to forward the thesis that he did research providing evidence for the theory that a cult of Shiva spread throughout the Mediterranean and eventually metamorphosized into Dionysus, which is interesting because that brings us to Jim Morrison. Jim Morrison was supposed to be a kind of a man, or I mean, I think he imagined himself to be a manifestation of Dionysus. He was more of an Aghori sadhu than a shaman. He was effective in using. He would go to the quote other side to get visions to bring back to his revelers, his worshipers, to create a desired change in consciousness. So I think maybe that's just another little micro manifestation of Shiva consciousness coming into the West at a time when the West was desperately, we were at our Cold War, nuclear, hyper-puritanical, Adam Smith, social Darwinism, the end of our rope. The young people had no other place to go. And their desire for a new consciousness, I think maybe did attract Shiva's attention, attracted Krishna's attention, attracted Kalima's attention. So, finally, gender equality. 1960s feminism may have been an emergence of Kali consciousness in the West. Feminism isn't especially, superficially anyway, compatible with a monotheistic religion that has an exclusively male deity. Feminism is, however, completely compatible with the worship of Kali. So were the feminists in the 60s walking around thinking, hey, let's manifest some Kali consciousness here? Maybe a couple, but most of them were not. I think it was a spontaneous emergence of that kind of consciousness. And in fact, people have moved away from an explicitly male god with a predominantly male clergy into alternative spirituality where males and females absolutely can both be clergy, can both be whatever, where Shiva and Shakti can both be worshipped together. And finally, as just kind of a footnote, on this, emergence of Shiva consciousness, the America of the 50s, by all accounts, was one which was saturated with socially accepted alcohol abuse. In the old movies, it's astonishing. There's always like a few decanters of hard liquor on every executive's desk, so he can offer someone a drink during the middle of the business day. And anecdotally, I've known so many people who lived through that time where parents drank and they were abusive to each other and to the children because of the alcohol use. So if you were a baby boomer and you were watching parents behave like this with alcohol, either they were silly or they were mean or they were sleepy. Maybe sometimes they'd be fine, but you know, alcohol's a terrible hard drug. So they looked at maybe a consciousness where alcohol is rejected in favor of meditation, preferably Kundalini meditation. Maybe that would be attractive to a generation who watched the grown-ups behaving so badly on alcohol. So Tobias Churton's thesis that the 1960s counterculture was a collective incarnation of Shiva in this world, I think you can find some evidence for that. I think it's a plausible hypothesis. I'll close with a personal anecdote. So when I was a small child, my baby boomer mother, my family was a staunch, high church, conservative, Episcopalian family. And yet my mother had a beautiful statue of the Buddha right in the kitchen window so that she can enjoy the Buddha with the morning sun, you know, as she made breakfast for everyone. And she would burn incense around the house. And I asked her several times, like, Mom, are you a Buddhist? No, I just, you know, I think it's very peaceful. So then fast forward to me at age 16 and sitting in my suburban upper middle class kid bedroom with the black light on and listening to Jim Morrison, listening to The Doors, listening to Jimi Hendrix, and seeing that there is a consciousness that is not available at the mall. It's not available on television. It's not available from the school system. There's a consciousness, though, that's inherently superior, subjectively, and in every other way, to the one that I've got right now. And I was looking for that consciousness. And so rock and roll did not have a trivial impact on my life. It led me to a great place. By the age of 21, I was doing all-night meditations and experienced a direct experience of emptiness for the first time. In later meditations of 48-plus hours during that same time period, I thought, I had the realization and noted in my journal, everything is a dream in the mind of God. So it's an oversimplification of the universe of samsara as a manifestation of divine consciousness. But it certainly is that, you know, that's a big step in that direction. And then I end up being a monk, a Sarasvati tradition, Shaivite monk. So thank you, Jim Morrison. Thank you, Ray Manzarek, Robbie Krueger, John Dinsmore. You guys did something very wonderful for a suburban kid in the early 80s. So now we've explored our hypothesis from Tobias Churton. I do recommend his book, The Spiritual Meaning of the 60s. It's a magnificent work. I think it's a rigorous work, and I really enjoyed it. I have no association with him or his publisher, but it was a fine book. And it does show, you know, when you see a yoga studio in your suburban neighborhood, or when you have a friend that's a vegetarian, or a friend that doesn't drink but they smoke a little bit of ganja with meditation, they did not arise out of a vacuum. Much of the animal rights movement, it did not arise out of a vacuum. I'm willing to speculate that based on an outcry of need and desire from the young people of that generation, there was a mass manifestation of Shiva consciousness in the 60s, and that it continues to the very present day. But we don't want to have half of a revolution. And I'm not talking about the kind of revolution where you have guns or where you have even votes. I'm talking about a revolution of consciousness. So many people have abandoned, you know, the neo-Victorian mainstream culture, but they've done so haphazardly. And that doesn't get you, you can't just leave something. You have to go from something to the next thing. So I'll close with an appeal. Go on eBay or Amazon or Etsy or wherever. Find some cheap sandalwood beads. Make some 108 bead small malas and carry one with you. And the next time you see a young person who has abandoned the mainstream culture or is critical or, you know, rejecting the mainstream culture, but they don't know what to grab a hold of, give them a mala and a little piece of paper with the Shiva mantra or whatever mantra of your choice. Give them something to move toward, not just because they know what they're moving away from. I'll close on a really optimistic note. I think this is all just beginning. I think this is the biggest leap forward for humanity since the Renaissance. And it's just now getting up to speed. So draw close to your guru. Draw close to your beloved deity. Cling to your mantra. Be faithful in your puja. Study your scriptures. Spread kindness and love and devotion and patience. May the God of the gods, from whose matted locks flows the sacred Ganges, bless and guide you all. Om Namah Shivaya.